next. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. There is a very special grandeur with that music of John Williams, and it, of course, comes from the Jurassic Park film and its sequel after that. And we are playing that right now because for the next few minutes, we're going to be talking about something quite exciting at the Field Museum in Chicago. There are all kinds of amazing things to experience at Chicago's Field Museum. But now through early January, you can also experience a special traveling exhibit that has only been seen in two other museums in the whole world. It is called Jurassic World, very much inspired by the third Jurassic film, so to speak. And I'm very, very excited to be able to speak with Tom Squirsky, who is Exhibitions Operations Director for the Field Museum. And he is here to tell us a little bit more about this particular exhibit and the wonders that it affords to those who will be fortunate enough to take it in. Tom Squirsky, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Craig.
And before we even talk about Jurassic World, I want to be sure to give you a chance to just say kind of an overarching word about the Chicago Field Museum. It's a place I have visited any number of times, and there are all kinds of amazing things to see and experience there. Just say a quick word about what it represents in the cultural landscape of the great city of Chicago and indeed the Midwest.
Sure. Yeah, the Field Museum of Natural History is one of the premier natural history museums, not only in America, but in the world. I mean, we have over 30 million specimens in our collection, less than 1% of which are actually on exhibit in our displays. But we do a whole host of rotating temporary exhibitions, but then we have over 25 acres of permanent displays as well. Jurassic World is actually a unique thing for us because it's in a tent that we literally had to build outside on the grounds of the museum. The dinosaurs wouldn't actually fit in our building. So, you know, visitors can come to the Field Museum and see our amazing collection of dinosaur fossils, some of the best in the world, and then go out and see in Jurassic World, the exhibition, what their imagination might have kind of fleshed out when they saw the fossils. So it's an amazing place to visit, whether this is your first time to Chicago or whether, like me, you came every day since you were for a long time.
Was there any trepidation about the Field Museum taking on this particular exhibit? And I don't even mean whatever cost is involved or logistical challenges, although we should probably talk about that a little bit. I mean more philosophically, because, of course, the story of Michael Crichton's original novel and these magnificent films that have sprung out of them are of course in a tangential way based on science, but of course are also very much rooted in imagination and ultimately fiction. So I just wonder, were there any philosophical conversations that took place, presumably behind closed doors at the Field Museum, about whether or not this was an appropriate thing for the Field Museum to help share with the world?
In short, yes, there were. I mean, you know, we are a scientific institution, and those issues were raised early on. And, you know, we talked about this with a lot of our scientists, and we said, look, you know, people come to science from different ways. I mean, it is not all pure academia. I mean, how many, I know our archaeologists hate this when I use this as an example, but how many archaeologists are out in the world today because they were inspired by, you know, the fictional character of Indiana Jones, or paleontologists who saw the first Jurassic Park movie and became so inspired to go into the, you know, the legitimate scientific field. So, I mean, we did have those conversations, but in the end, you know, we thought that having an exhibition like Jurassic World here allowed us to kind of combine science with science fiction. And we say to our visitors, you know, please, you've seen these animatronic dinosaurs. Now go see the real fossils that we have inside in our Evolving Planet exhibition.
Right, and go take a look at Sue in all of her
absolutely.
Majesty.
You know, and it's not as if it's totally devoid of any scientific content. There's actually quite a bit of panels and displays that has actual scientific content about T-Rex, how big she was, what she ate, you know, or other dinosaurs like velociraptors and things like that. So the scientific content is there in the exhibition. Now, it is married next to, you know, displays about extracting DNA from insects, because that's what the movie itself is based on, and so the exhibition is based on that movie. But they exist side by side in the exhibition.
Hmm. So tell us a little bit about what was logistically involved in bringing this exhibit to the Field Museum. I know one of the most important questions once it was decided that you wanted to have it at the Field Museum was, where in the world to put it? This is as good a moment as any to talk about, in a sense, the dimensions of this spectacular exhibit.
Sure, yeah. You know, I mentioned briefly that it's in a tent outside of our building. And, you know, I mean, there is a life-size animatronic T-Rex in there that is over 40 feet long. And the tent itself is about 17,000 square feet. And so when we looked at our available spaces here at the museum, and we said, if we took all of our temporary exhibition galleries together, they run about 15,000 square feet. So we didn't have the square footage to put it in the building, let alone the fact that the tent itself has a ceiling height of about 40 feet. And our tallest ceilings in our galleries are about 18 feet. So, you know, it became pretty apparent early on that we weren't going to get this in our building. And then we started to investigate other ways that we could bring it to Chicago.
Right. And, of course, we shouldn't give people the wrong idea when we start talking about a tent set up outside of the Field Museum.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a tent like probably most people have never seen in their lives.
Yeah, I think until the horse show opened up across the way, we did have the biggest tent structure in Chicago. There's this pretty big, too. But, and actually just to get the exhibition here, I mean, it came in over 25 semis from Philadelphia, where it was at before us. And they worked for really almost 2.5 weeks, 24 hours a day, getting everything in place.
Wow. By the way, what was sort of the teamwork involved in terms of your staff at the Field Museum versus whatever staff came along with these semi-trucks, with the exhibit themselves? And what has it taken to, in a sense, do the actual physical mounting of this?
Right, yeah, and that's something that, you know, normally when we bring in an exhibition from an outside venue or something like that, it's pretty much all our staff, who our exhibition staff and production staff, who do the installation work and all the lighting and all the setup and everything like that. In this instance, however, the exhibition came with an entirely independent crew. They contracted out with some stage people who helped out with the setup and things like that. But pretty much, I was the main field museum involvement in this. Everything else came from the outside.
So let's give our listeners a little clearer sense of what they are going to experience once they walk in the door. And I realize that there are probably certain special moments in this exhibit that maybe you prefer for our listeners to experience in the moment as a surprise, but I think at least generally we can paint a pretty vivid picture, I hope, of what they will experience, see, hear, smell when they walk in the door.
Sure, yeah, it's at its core, it is an animatronic dinosaur experience. And, you know, there are these kind of tableaus that are set up that are based on the exhibition, or based on the movie itself. So, you know, there's the Gentle Giants petting zoo. There's the Land of the Giants, where you get to come face-to-face with a Parasaurolophus and a Brachiosaurus. There is a Velociraptor training experience, which is really cool. And then the T-Rex, of course, plays a huge part in the kind of the central climax of the experience, and then we move on to Gyrosphere Valley. So you kind of go from one experience to another. There's some lab spaces where you can learn and do some cool digital interactives and things like that. But it's very much an experience that you kind of go through as a group, and you watch videos and see the dinosaurs and everything.
What kind of expense, you don't have to get real specific here, but what kind of expense does this represent for the Field Museum in terms of above and beyond what you already do? And was that a sizable challenge to surmount in deciding that this could be part of the Field Museum?
Well, I think that we'd done our research early on. We'd spoken to both of the previous venues before that, before us, and they told us that their attendance for this exhibition had been higher than any other previous exhibition they'd had, and it made the decision a lot easier on our part when we realized that, you know, this could really be one of those kind of rare exhibitions that come along every once in a while that, you know, we hate to use the word blockbuster all the time, but it's something, you know, King Tut, you know, we just did an exhibition on Terracotta Warriors last year, and everyone's always kind of looking for it. What is that next blockbuster? And we really thought that the popularity of the Jurassic film series was really one of the things that this had going for it. So, I mean, yes, it was a difficult financial decision to make. I mean, it's a very expensive exhibition not only to bring in but to run. I mean, these are complex mechanical creatures, and they have a staff that are here pretty much 24 hours a day to take care of them. There are actually people on staff called dinosaur wranglers. It sounds like a fun job, but they're the ones that keep these dinosaurs running, and they actually live here in Chicago. They travel with the exhibit. So, you know, there is a great expense in running the show, not only just bringing it here. But we felt confident that it was an exhibition that our visitors would embrace and come see.
Mm. Well, and there really is something pretty incredible about people being this excited about going to a museum. I've had that experience several times in Chicago. Among many I can think of is when there was a Van Gogh Gauguin exhibit at the Art Institute, and I just remember standing there shoulder to shoulder in this exhibit and just kind of looking around me and just thinking, this is the greatest thing in the world in this age where so much of us spend way too much of our time in front of screens at home. for people to be this excited about going to a museum. And, of course, once they're there, your hope is, of course, that they will return many times thereafter.
Yeah. I mean, it's really an experience to see these in person. I mean, these are I've seen a lot of animatronic dinosaurs in my life. I've been in museums for a long time. And these, by far, are the best animatronic dinosaurs I've ever seen. I mean, their movements are so fluid. The skin is so realistic looking. I mean, do you really believe, suspend your disbelief for a few minutes there and think, wow, this could be real. I mean, it's an amazing experience to have in person. You know, photos and videos really don't do it justice.
So explain to our listeners what they should do if they are intrigued by this and would like to experience Jurassic World at the Field Museum for themselves.
Mm-hmm. So fieldmuseum.org is our website. Visitors can go on to it, and they can purchase tickets. It is an additional ticket that you have to buy for Jurassic World in addition to your admission to the museum itself. But you can do all that online, or you can call the Field Museum. The number is also on the website there. You can purchase your tickets over the phone, or you can purchase them here on site. And we have, you know, obviously vendors who will sell you tickets here on site as well.
Very good. What was the website address again for the Field Museum?
Fieldmuseum, one word, .org. We are an org, O-R-G.
Very good. Tom Skwirsky is Exhibitions Operations Director for the Chicago Field Museum, and we are talking about this special visiting exhibit called Jurassic World, which is on site now through the 7th of January. Tom Skwirsky, I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show. Very best wishes to you and all of your colleagues at the Field Museum.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate it.
The time is 8:28, and you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. Well, there are more than spectacular dinosaurs to see at the Chicago Field Museum. And in addition to all of the sort of ongoing exhibits there, there is one in particular that caught my eye that I am very, very excited to take in when time permits, namely an exhibit focusing on tattoos. And I'm very excited to be able to speak for the next few minutes with Janet Hong, who is Exhibitions Project Manager for the Chicago Field Museum. And she really helps to oversee the installation of the various exhibits that come in and out of the Field Museum on a fairly regular basis. And she's also in a position to tell us a little bit more about this particular exhibit about tattoos, which is on display at the Field Museum until the 4th of September. Janet Hong, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. Glad to be here.
Glad to talk with you. I've always enjoyed my visits to the Field Museum, and it's really fun to be able to talk to someone who has had a hand in many of the interesting things that have been seen there. Give our listeners a little more specific idea of what you do as Exhibitions Project Manager. What does that really mean?
Well, we produce about 10 to 12 new exhibitions per year in different topics in natural history, which could mean anything, really, because that means natural sciences and human cultures. And we make our own exhibitions from scratch, so to speak, as well as working with museums around the world. So we work with scientists here on staff, researchers, as well as writers, architectural designers, really specialized artisans and craftsmen who make the physical things that you see in an exhibition.
Take us inside the decisions that get made in terms of what is going to be shared with the public at the Field Museum, what exhibitions are going to be brought in.
Uh-huh.
What kind of conversations take place? What sort of considerations are weighed?
Well, for example, this summer we've got this great family dinosaur experience outside the building, Jurassic World. And we thought over the summer a great complement to that would be a continuation of our exhibition about tattooing. That's more for adults, and it's quite a serious exhibition, a deep dive into this topic that turns out to be incredibly rich and incredibly fascinating around the world. So we like to have a range of programming for families that visit or groups of friends that visit.
So let's find out a little more about this specific exhibit that focuses on tattoos, which is only on display until the 4th of September. So people actually should not dawdle. They should start making their plans right now in terms of paying a visit to the museum to see this. First of all, is this one of those exhibits that travels around that has come from some other place, or is this an exhibit, in a sense, built by the Field Museum themselves?
Well, it's an exhibition that originally began in Paris at a museum that's about 10 years old called the Musée de Quai Branly Jacques Chirac. It's near the Eiffel Tower. And they assembled a wonderful group of objects and artifacts and artworks to describe tattooing around the world. Here at our museum, we're hosting it with things from the Field Museum's own collections of things from Africa, from Asia, and we definitely have a local story to tell, too, because tattoo culture in Chicago is very, very interesting.
Right. So you've taken this and sort of shaped it to be especially fitting for the Chicago Field Museum.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot to explore from our own collections here, for sure.
Right. I know that one facet of this exhibit involves the tools of tattoo.
Tell us
what that facet of the exhibit is about.
Well, when you think about the physicality of tattooing, it's really interesting. For centuries, the basic tool was some kind of pointy instrument. Could be cactus needles, could be a shark's tooth, could be like a pointy bit of bone, and some kind of ink to deposit beneath the surface of the skin, which was usually something burnt, some kind of soot or carbon. So we've got a really fascinating array of older instruments and instruments that are still used today to make hand-tapped tattooing in different parts of the world. And we also have an example of this revolutionary device that was partly invented by Thomas Edison, actually, in the 1880s. It's a precursor to the electric device, which makes tattoos so much more available to so many people around the world. Originally, Thomas Edison invented a sort of stencil pen, and that got repurposed and repatented as an electric automatic tattooing machine. So, yeah, we're really happy to have examples of this great panoply of things that you can use to indelibly ink your skin, your person, with images and text.
Wow. I understand that this exhibit also involves, at least on certain occasions, maybe certain days or at certain times, being able to step into a working tattoo shop. I mean, to actually see this being done. Explain how that's possible.
Well, it was a little crazy idea. But yes, we have a fully licensed tattoo shop within the exhibition. And it's on certain weekends of the summer. And the clients who are getting tattoos have already signed up, and the tattoo artists who work in the studio are some of Chicago's finest artists. Visitors are allowed to go into the shop while the tattooing is going on and look through windows, because we wanted to portray that this is a living art form and a living cultural practice. And the physical work of depositing ink below the skin, it is very, very interesting. So we're very glad to be able to bring this physical aspect of tattooing to the public.
I know that one of the points that is made by your exhibit is that the purpose of tattoos varies widely, and
That's right, and
especially for those of us who have never indulged in the practice and have no plans to ever do so, and maybe you're kind of mystified by it, this is maybe helpful for us to understand why so many people all over the world and down through the centuries have done this for so many very different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, it's just exploded in the West, certainly in the U.S. and Europe over the past 15 years. And, you know, you look at all these surveys, and just about half of all millennials have a tattoo now. But definitely, these are practices that have been on all continents for centuries often. And some parts of the world have really made it into an art form and a very rich cultural practice. I mean, definitely, I don't know, hipsters these days, well, we're doing it for self-expression, to celebrate an achievement we've done, or to maybe to memorialize something very important to us that's internal that we want to make manifest on our skin, on our exterior, so we can memorialize it more. But in some parts of the world, it can be a religious practice. There are tattoos that are actual prayers that are inked on your skin that can be activated with rituals to make them even more powerful as prayers. There are certainly examples of people feeling that tattoos have been healing practices. For example, there was a man who was found in the Italian Alps named Uzi, the Iceman. He died about 5,000 years ago, and he's almost perfectly preserved. And his 61 tattoos are most often at sites where he had little injuries. People can tell from CAT scans. So 5,000 years ago in Italy, people thought that marking your skin with soot would help you recover from injuries. So ideas about tattoos have definitely been evolving for centuries and have many, many meanings around the world.
Right. I thought it was so interesting on the website of the museum where this is discussed. At one point, they said that in some cases the tattoos are for the sake of affiliation, for feeling like you are and appearing to be part of a particular group. And then,
absolutely.
And then in other cases, to get a tattoo is because someone wants to set themselves apart as a unique individual with presumably an array of tattoos that no one else in the world exactly possesses. It's just really interesting. It really got me thinking about something that, as I said before, has always been pretty much bewildering to me. It was interesting to read about all of that. And I know that, and you've already touched on this, the fact that we are talking about in this exhibit something that really examines this phenomenon on a global scale.
That's right, yeah. I'm glad you pointed out that tension between individualism and tribal identity. That's just something very interesting to think about, yeah.
Absolutely. Tell us about this other facet of the exhibit, which involves 15 life-size forms that have been decorated by some major artists. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, we thought a lot about how to portray this living art form. And, you know, it's something that people have on their bodies, so it's a moving artwork, if you will. And 4D also, it's something that changes over time as skin changes. And, you know, we thought about different ways to portray tattoos. We certainly have lots of films and beautiful photographs and paintings portraying tattoos. But what the Musée de Quai Branly of Paris did was to commission life-size body parts to be physically tattooed by some of the greatest tattoo artists living in the world now. So these artists took life-size replications of arms and torsos and legs and physically tattooed them, either by hand tapping or by electrical tattooing machines. And that is a great way to portray this art form because, you know, when somebody has a tattoo, you can't really ask them to, you know, scrutinize their arm or certainly their torsos for any period of time. But with these sculptures in the gallery, you can take a good long look at the art of these contemporary artists. They're a little disconcerting to see in the gallery. You know, they're hyper-realistic forms, but you can really get a good look at all these different styles that are used throughout Europe, the Pacific, definitely in the United States also. Definitely worth seeing.
Right. I also wanted to have you touch on a facet of this exhibit, which is actually tied specifically to the museum's website,
okay,
where, in fact, you ask for people to share their own tattoo stories about tattoos that they have and why they have gotten them and so on. What prompted the museum to do that, and what kind of response have you had?
A great response, and I hope your listeners will go to fieldmuseum.org and find the area where you can share your tattoo stories. Tattoo stories, I mean, most people have some kind of narrative around the imagery that they've put on their skin. So it could be because they're memorializing a loved one, or it could be because it's a leftover from spring break, or from grad school, having finished a college degree or a degree or some other achievement. So it's a very interesting way for people to not just share things via Instagram, but actually have their stories and photographs of their tattoos inside the gallery, in the exhibition itself, because there's a large monitor that shares images and text from people sharing on hashtag TattooFM.
It's a wonderful idea, and I am curious. My previous guest from the Field Museum briefly alluded to this, but he suggested that this tattoo exhibit has probably drawn to the Field Museum at least a few visitors very much specifically interested in this exhibit, and maybe people who might not otherwise have been inclined to visit the Field Museum. Is that your sense as well, that this has attracted to the museum not only some of your faithful followers, but also some newcomers to the museum?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, definitely younger people have a very serious interest in tattoos. And we've had some late night events that have not only sold out, but there have been like aftermarket scalping of tickets. That was really surprising to us. The exhibition has mostly, up until now, been open during cold months in Chicago. So people have, visitors have kept their tattoos covered going through the exhibition. But now that the weather is warmer, I'm realizing that a lot of visitors are able to have their tattoos uncovered now, now that it's warmer. So I think that just makes the experience all the more interesting. And I think it's going to be a great summer here, too.
Fantastic. So we want to remind our listeners that this fascinating exhibit called Tattoo is on display at the Chicago Field Museum until the 4th of September. Janet Hong, in our last couple minutes, I want to give you the opportunity to highlight some other things that are worth seeing and experiencing at the Chicago Field Museum?
You know, you got to come over and see the superb exhibition called Specimens, which is the story of the Field Museum's natural history collections and why the Field Museum needs to collect rocks and birds and plants from all over the world. It's really thought-provoking, and it really makes you understand the worth of collecting things for scientists now and in the future. It's really fun to look at. Coming up in the fall, we'll open an exhibition about the interchange of Mediterranean cultures also. That's called Ancient Mediterranean Cultures in Contact. That will open in October 20th.
And, of course, the museum is full of sort of standard ongoing exhibits that give people all kinds of interesting things to see and experience.
Yes. Well, the whole history of life on Earth, actually, 4 billion years. Always, it's inspiring and truly beautiful to walk through the exhibition called Evolving Planet. And just think about all the plants, all the animals that have been on our Earth for so many millions and billions of years. That's always something fun to do with your family or on a date or with your friends. You got to come on over.
The Field Museum has a beautiful website called fieldmuseum.org in which you can explore all that is offered by the Chicago Field Museum. And again, we want to remind people of the tattoo exhibit that is open through the 4th of September and the Jurassic World exhibit, which we talked about in part one, which is open at the Field Museum until early January. Janet Hong is Exhibitions Project Manager at the Chicago Field Museum. Janet Hong, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes.
Greg, thanks a million.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. It's exactly 8:47. Part 3 is coming up. Well, I am used to books crossing my path and piling up on my desk, but what arrived in the mail the other day was something quite out of the ordinary. At a glance, it looked for all the world like a bag of potato chips. But if you looked a little more closely, even before opening it, you knew it was something else. On the package, it said, Potato Chip Science, Book and Stuff. And below that, explore major branches of science, 29 incredible experiments, physics, biology, chemistry, and earth science. And up at the top, warning, high in saturated facts. And this is the work of Alan Kurzweil and Son. They are a father-son partnership, they like to call it, of snack food researchers, and they have cooked up this idea together. And you may know Alan Kurzweil as the award-winning author of Leon and the Champion Chip, Leon and the Spitting Image, The Grand Complication, and A Case of Curiosity. And we're going to find out a little bit about how the two of them, that is, father and son, came up with this wonderful idea and created this wonderful kit together, which is published by Workman Publishing. Alan Kurzweil, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg.
So where's your son this morning? Is he doing any of the publicity for this project, or is he busy with other matters?
Currently, it's a holiday at the moment, so he's currently sleeping downstairs.
Ah.
But yes, he is the principal beta taster and beta tester for Potato Chip Science, and he was the one who kicked me in the rump to do something a little bit more user-friendly than the subjects I usually explored, antique pocket watches and the like. He is the potato chip fiend behind Potato Chip Science.
Very good. This is a really interesting mix of ingredients and experiments, and it might be interesting just to begin by explaining to listeners, if they get this bag and open it up, what exactly they're going to find.
Okay. Well, what happens is if you walk into a bookstore, or you go online and you look at potato chip science, you will be staring at a big honking potato chip bag. You tear it open, as I'm about to do right now, and you dump it out onto the table, and you will find inside a 96-page book, a sound chip that's powered off of a potato, a small propulsion pipe tube, a clock, again powered by a potato, some optical stickers, an eco-friendly knife, some wire connectors, electrodes, the obligatory googly eyes. You have to have the googly eyes. And
yes,
you basically are introduced to a world of science that exploits the miraculous qualities of America's, and in fact the world's, most popular snack food. So when we were growing up, Greg, we learned about the five branches of science: biology, chemistry, physics, and the like. Well, this book repurposes or reinvents science and gives kids the opportunity to perceive of science as five branches of potato chip science, those being bags, chips, lids, spuds, and tubes. And so using those basic materials that they harvest from the recycling bin, they can learn about biology, or they can learn about Bernoulli's principle. They can build kites. They can build chipmobiles. They can build stomp rockets, all using these materials we usually think of as trash.
I think that one interesting little bit is in the introduction in the booklet, you stop to write a moment about matters of safety, which in some respects is probably enticing for some young people to know that they're doing stuff that they have to be sort of careful about as they do it. I mean, there's just this element of danger there.
Well, danger, of course, is an important part of discovery. I mean, where would Franklin have been without lightning striking as close as it did? But, you know, of course, there's the competing impulse to keep things safe. And so all of the experiments in this book were tested rigorously before they made it in, and we took out a lot. My son and I, for instance, had a habit, for research purposes only, of launching a potato about 300 yards using a 6-foot-long exterminator. But obviously we couldn't put that into the kit. So we reduced the scale, and we have a small 6-inch propulsion pipe that really risks almost nothing and teaches kids about Boyle's Law, the inverse relationship of volume and pressure. So, yes, I mean, there's a lot of fun to be had. The kids can carve shrunken potato heads. They can launch the packing peanuts that are inside, the packing chips that are inside this bag, serve double duty as the ammo for the confetti cannon they build. It's all about showing kids that they can learn about science. They can learn about science by making things. They can turn off their computers and their video games and really explore the world around them simply by pulling open the recycling bin or grabbing a few things from the grocery store.
One thing I really appreciate is that there is something of the methodical required for some of this, and even before a lot of these experiments get started. I mean, that we find a spread towards the beginning of the book in which you talk the young scientists through how they can take an empty potato chip bag that they found somewhere and essentially prepare it for the experiments that they can do with it. And that in and of itself is important, not necessarily the sexiest way to spend your time, but it's important. And that's probably a good lesson for a youngster to be learning, that it isn't just about blowing things up in the first 10 seconds.
That's right. Although that moment of blowing things up is crucial, too. I wouldn't undervalue the opportunity to make mistakes and to make a mess and to take things apart. But that's right. There is a measure of rigor that is introduced to the book, but it's done so subversively. It's done with the kids in mind. So, for instance, the system that this kit introduces is called the system. And those four M's are easy for kids to remember, but they are the basic principles that the folks at NASA also use. The first M is materials. You have to know what you need. The second M is method. You have to know how to do it. And the third and most important M is, of course, the meaning. What do you learn? What's the takeaway from blowing things up or from launching confetti cannons or for building a chipmobile. And then finally, the final indulgent M is the little munchies, the little morsels of information that expand kids' imagination. So, for instance, they learn that if you put all the potato chips that we consume in a single year end to end, they would reach from their research facility in their kitchen to the moon and back 23 times.
Hmm. That really makes you think, doesn't it?
It does.
The various chapters of this book deal with the chips themselves or the lids on the cans or the bags and all kinds of different experiments that one can do, including certain experiments involving the plain old potato itself. Can you just say a word about how these experiments came together? And, I mean, were you sort of blowing things up and trying and failing and in perfecting these experiments to the point where we find them in the book?
Yeah. If you had the misfortune of walking into my basement, well, of attempting to walk into my basement, you would have to navigate around six or seven cases of potato chips, a bunch of sacks of potatoes, about 4,000 chip lids, and a whole bunch of empty bags. And my son and I spent months and months and months cooking up all these experiments, testing up down in the basement or, when necessary, outside. And so we just did what a lot of scientists do, you know, just trial and error, figuring out how to perfect them, and then, of course, figuring out how to illustrate and communicate them. All of the science experiments, for instance, the materials are always not just listed but illustrated, because some kids may know what an eye screw is. Other kids won't know what an eye screw is, but if you see a picture of an eye screw, you know exactly what you have to rustle up to make, for example, the bird feeder out of a plastic potato chip tube. So it was a long process back and forth where language, of course, is important and text is important, but the most important thing, of course, is the fun, the sense of getting kids as excited about science as they are about a bag of potato chips.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention to our listeners, especially for those that maybe don't have young people in the home who might have read your previous books, that it's no accident that what you are focusing on here is potato chips as sort of the medium by which all of this gets done. Explain how this ties into some of your previous works.
Well, I've written a series of children's books with this, featuring this character, Leon. And Leon, like my son Max, loves potato chips. So what started as a very casual interest in potato chips became more and more obsessive in the household. And so by the time I started sitting down to write book two, that interest in potato chips morphed into a scientific curriculum presented by one of the characters in the second book named Franklin Sparks. And he saw that kids were bored to death with the kind of science experiments and lessons plans they had to endure as fifth graders. And he said, okay, guys, what do you care about? Leon, of course, has two of the most magic words in the English language, potato chips. All the other kids go crazy. And Franklin Sparks says in the book, okay, we will study science using potato chips and nothing but potato chips for the next 9 months, and hence the birth of potato chip science.
And it can be yours as well. And again, it's an absolutely wonderful way to get, for that matter, young and old, interested in science in a whole different way. Potato chip science, book and stuff. When you find it on a shelf, it's going to look like a bag of potato chips. But trust me, there's all kinds of great things inside. And A. Kurzweil and Son are responsible for this. It's from Workman Publishing. Alan Kurzweil, what a pleasure to speak with you. I've long admired your work, and this most recent product of your creativity is something very, very special, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
It was my pleasure.
Bye-bye. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's Nan Calvert paying her monthly visit to the program, and with her will be Joan Rohr to talk about some of the efforts she has made to help educate children on the importance of clean, fresh water. On Friday, postponed from 2 weeks ago, the author of a fascinating book called Incendiary, which looks at a true life crime story from Boston in the mid-19th century that helped transform the way crime is investigated. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. A reminder that tonight's concert of the Kenosha Pops Band will be held in Library Park,